From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. I'm filling in while Terry Gross is on vacation. Today, I speak with Yale history professor Paul Kennedy. His new book examines how, throughout history, the great powers have fallen victim to what Kennedy calls imperial overstretch. Also today, I speak with guitarist David Tannenbaum. He's had an eclectic career, creating new transcriptions of works by Bach and Scarlatti, and also playing works by modern composers like Steve Reich. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new albums from George Strait and Steve Wariner, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Biloxi Blues, the movie version of Neil Simon's Broadway hit. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Kennedy, the author of the new bestseller, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. According to Time magazine, this is the book that U.S. policymakers and pundits are currently lugging around in their briefcases. Kennedy, who is a professor of history at Yale, studied economic change and military conflict from 1500 to 2000 to chart how the interaction of these forces have affected the rise and fall of nations. This dense, detailed 670-page work is presently number two on the New York Times bestseller list. I spoke with Paul Kennedy from WAMU Radio in Washington, D.C. I asked him what it means to be a great power.
I'd make a distinction, of course, between great in a moral sense, which certain countries could be without being militarily powerful or economically strong, but traditionally we have looked at great powers as being a composite of economic strength and military fighting capacity.
Is the United States the greatest power in the world?
It still is, using that combination of military strength and underpinning economic and technological capacity. But it is less great, less far ahead in that sense, that definition, than it was, say, in 1945 or 1955.
But how serious is it? I mean, are we dying?
No. This is a question I get asked a lot, and I have to keep saying no as if I'm some veterinary surgeon or morphologist or something. What we're talking about and what I've tried to discuss in the book is relative decline and relative rise of the great powers. And the argument in the final chapter is that the United States is now relatively less wealthy, has a relatively smaller share of world manufacturing output and gross national product than it had 40 years ago. Absolutely, most Americans are better off than they were 40 years ago, and this country is richer and in a certain way stronger than then. But relative to other countries, and relative therefore to all of the burdens and obligations the United States has had since 40 years ago, it is somewhat weaker.
Well, when I read your book, I learned this. We have two problems in the United States that have been disastrous for some other nations. Now, one of them is an overcommitment to projects overseas. What kinds of involvements did you have in mind?
I first of all want to say that if one looked at the overall record of American commitments overseas, then disastrous would be unfair. The American commitments to restore Western Europe after 1945, the defense agreements with Japan in 1951, a whole number of other ones to sustain other countries and members of the free world have surely, on the whole, been very good and very useful to the United States. But the tendency of a great power, number one world power, has been to intervene or to be drawn into an array of conflicts across the globe, some of which, as in Vietnam, some of which possibly impending now in Latin America, have not been so good for those societies with the large-scale American military presence, and in a way have had a counterproductive effect upon the American position as number one.
All right. The other serious problem for other nations was an unbalanced budget.
It's not so serious for other nations, I think, so long as the United States relies upon the constant infusion of foreign, especially Japanese monies, to cover our present yawning federal government deficit. In a certain sense, the Japanese surplus of capital pouring over here is keeping the money out of Japan and reducing its inflation, and it is supporting the United States from a recession and a major crisis. But in strategical terms and over the long term, this ever-growing reliance of the United States economy, because of its federal deficit and its need to borrow, upon foreign capital, places some warning signs over its economic and fiscal future, and the lessons of history suggest that one shouldn't get into that position of being so dependent upon foreign finance.
Well, I understand that there's probably a line drawn under the word warning signs. But if we have these two serious problems, does that mean if we don't fix them, everything will completely fall apart?
I would not go that far. In the first place, let me just say that the book is, again, about relative decline rather than absolute decline. It's also not a historian's equivalent of that book which is on the market. I think it's called The Coming Collapse of 1990. Mm-hmm. It's not about the coming global strategical crisis of 1990. It is calling attention to the fact that the United States has all of the obligations in the world which it took up 30 or 40 years ago when it was much stronger relative to others. And it asks the question whether there isn't now an imbalance between the United States' share of economic and manufacturing strength and its vast overseas commitments and military capacities and expenditures on the other hand. And shouldn't we try to adjust both in the domestic sense of becoming more competitive economically, but also perhaps even rethinking the overseas commitments themselves?
Well, could the United States ever fall apart?
I can't conceive of a circumstance in which it could, and it's all things are possible. Historians are not soothsayers and forecasters, but it does strike me that the United States' social coherence and economic coherence is still considerably much better than that of the Soviet Union, and the problems that this country faces are significantly lighter than those faced by Mr. Gorbachev at the moment.
I wondered, your book made me think about what it would look like if this country did fall apart. I have trouble imagining it.
Well, so have I, and it's not something that I tried to speculate on in the final part of the book, though in that chapter called To the 21st Century, I do suggest long-term trends and long-term problems which all of the great powers face, but I don't cover any form of social disintegration or American equivalent of the fall of the Roman Empire, because I don't see that as being the problem. I think the problem is much more a growing gap between this country's capacity to sustain its overseas obligations and its shrinking economic base. And it's more in that sense that I talk about the relative decline of American power.
People study military history or they study economics as a way of finding out why countries decline. Is it unusual to combine the two things as you did?
Oh, I think so. As you may know, in the field of history, as in most other disciplines, there's been an awful disintegration into specialist subfields. So that somebody is an expert on the economic history of Prussia in the 18th century, but nothing else. Or on the military history of Bavaria in the 20th century, but nothing else. Bringing together the different parts of the subject of history, and in particular connecting the economic aspects of history with the military and strategical aspects of history, do seem to me important. And writing the occasional broad general book for a readership other than history professionals also strikes me as very important.
My guest is Yale Professor Paul Kennedy, author of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. You've looked at this great span of time from the year 1500 through the present and even projecting into the year 2000. Now, briefly, what are a few of the patterns that you saw emerging around the world?
Well, I cover the period from 1500 to the year 2000 because it seems as if that's when, in 1500, the modern nation state takes off. That's when beginnings of a global system of power with the expansion of Europe begins. But within that global system of power, one always finds some states relatively growing, relatively increasing their share, and others declining and shrinking. And the argument in the book, I'm putting this very crudely indeed, 700 pages down to 2 minutes, is that The expansion of the great powers relatively and their contraction relatively can usually be detected, first of all, in their economic base, in the share of manufacturing output, in the share of commerce, and the share of entrepreneurship. As they grow economically, after a while they begin to expand militarily. On the other hand, if they slow down, if they become mature economies, if their growth rates begin to fall off, as has indeed happened to the United States and the Soviet Union since the 1960s, then their long-term future as military great powers may be placed in question, because you cannot sustain large defense forces year after year on a relatively shrinking manufacturing and economic base. This we can see in the case of Imperial Spain, of France, of Edwardian Britain, and these sort of tendencies are already continuing and observable in the world today in respect of the two great superpowers.
Well, what was the lesson to be learned from Britain, let's say, at one time the greatest power?
Yes.
And a country that eventually gave up many of its territories?
Well, I would say twofold, because the argument in the book is a twofold one. One is about external policy, that is, how to handle your overseas commitments, whether one can possibly withdraw from some of them, rearrange them, have less in the way of obligations. And in a way, I think the British picture in the first half of the 20th century was one of relatively clever and sensible withdrawals from certain exposed areas in the Western Hemisphere, in the Far East, and parts of Africa, so that they did actually devolve some of their overseas responsibilities in order to reduce their commitments and to give their defense forces a chance of looking after the commitments which were left. The other side of the coin, and the lesson which I think many Americans are now considering as they debate the decline of Britain and the implications for themselves, is that Great Britain did not manage to deal with the challenge, if you like, of a high-tech, competitive revolution, a manufacturing revolution, in the early 20th century. It didn't put enough resources into commercial research and development. It didn't have a high enough amount of resources going into the creation of a well-trained workforce. It was producing far too many lawyers and far too many doctors and not enough engineers and scientists. Therefore, there are some things which do seem to repeat themselves in history, and the British case of its industrial decline and overtaking is one, I think, that concerns a number of commentators in Washington and elsewhere in this country at the moment.
Is, back to the United States again, is our dominance as a nation weakening because we've made mistakes, or is it happening just because other countries are getting stronger?
Both things are happening at the same time. The relative decline of the United States since 1945 in part is, of course, because of the success of the United States in helping the battered economies of Western Europe and of Japan to recover after the Second World War. So that the United States' share of, say, world manufacturing, which in 1945 was about 50% of the whole, a staggeringly high figure, was to that degree an artificial one. It was bound to come down when the economies of the other societies ruined by war recovered. But whether it should have come down so much, whether it should continue to be declining year on year because the American economy's growth rates from the 60s into the 70s and into the 80s have become less and less, is, I think, a more worrying sign of a lack of economic and manufacturing competitiveness, of a concern for consumption and conspicuous spending and borrowing rather than investment in the future. And in this connection, spending too much on consumption and spending a large amount on defense, but not spending enough on investment in the future, in terms of commercial research and development, increasing the savings ratio, increasing the flow of engineers and scientists, is a worrying part and is something that ought to concern all American citizens.
Well, who will emerge now as the real strength as this century moves toward a close?
The book argues that what we've seen over the past 30 or 40 years has been a world, a bipolar world, a world dominated by the two great superpowers of the United States and the Soviet Union. Militarily, to a large degree, it still is dominated by those superpowers. But at the economic level, what's happening is a devolution, a different pattern emerging. And I argue that what's happening is that we're moving from a bipolar world, dominated by the two superpowers, to much more of a multipolar world. Japan, for example, in economic terms, last year overtook the Soviet Union in total gross national product, which is, of course, one reason why Mr. Gorbachev is so worried about the Soviet Union.
So Japan's going to be a front runner.
Japan is economically extraordinarily productive, and China is growing even faster at the moment, doubling its gross national product every 7 years. So China and Japan in the Far East, according to some predictions, will be clearly ahead in size of their economies, clearly ahead of the Soviet Union, and perhaps even getting close to the United States in 20 to 25 years' time. We're talking, therefore, about at least four big powers, and we're not quite sure if Western Europe can get its act together and be a fifth big power. This is at the economic level. It's already there in shares of world manufacturing output and shares of world total gross national product. It will be some time before these economic shares of world power begin to be translated into military shares. But the pattern of history over the past 500 years, which I try to explore in the book, suggests that relative economic strength, roughly speaking, translates after some decades into relative military strength. So we are looking forward to a much more complicated world, not a bipolar world, but a multipolar world in, say, quarter of a century's time.
My guest is Paul Kennedy. He's a professor of history at Yale and author of the new book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, Economic Change and Military Conflict from 1500 to 2000. We talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Yale professor Paul Kennedy, author of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. You have said you feel the United States has a good chance of adjusting to problems because we're more flexible than some other countries. I wonder, though, if our political leaders, in your opinion, have enough of a global perspective, enough understanding about the world economy.
I think I would make a distinction between the present and perhaps the past few years, generation of political leaders, all of whom were brought up, let's recall it, during the Second World War and immediately after the Second World War, and that is their formative political time. It's very difficult, psychologically and culturally, to think yourself into a new era and to appreciate that the world has changed so much. On the other hand, it does strike me when I go in and out of Washington as being a very large number of younger Republican and Democratic senators and congressmen who know the world has changed and who want to do some things about it. They will openly admit that the sort of significant structural, economic, and technological and educational changes needed to keep the United States competitive as it goes into the 21st century are difficult to carry out. But nonetheless, I think they see the size and dimensions of the problem better than an older generation of politicians did.
Yeah. You know, in the United States, we've been known to look at things in almost a we are the center of the universe kind of way. Do you think that's blinded us from seeing what's really going on?
Let me say, as a historian, if it's any consolation, that of course, is the pattern, that is the cultural assumption of the number one in world history at almost any time. Imperial Spain and the Spaniards in the 16th and 17th century thought they were the center of the world. Your mid-Victorian Britons were sure that they were at the pinnacle of world civilization. Therefore, a repetition of that cultural attitude, that sense of superiority by American citizens is well understandable. The danger is it can blind you to the fact that other societies may be growing faster, may be more successful in their arrangements, whether they are constitutional or managerial or labor-saving or other arrangements or educational arrangements. So there's a danger in that assumption, but it's a one which has been seen many times before in world history.
Has your English upbringing and education at Oxford given you a kind of distance, you know, from the United States that's proved helpful in seeing us?
I think if you move to another country, you always have to make a certain number of comparisons, and you become rather more distant about the country you've moved from and look at it perhaps more objectively. But you also, I think, look at the country you have come to, I hope, with more objective detachment, because you were not brought up to assume all of its norms and all of its expectations. I would add further to that, though, that when I was at Oxford, my area of first specialization was the debate which went on in Edwardian Britain about whether it could sustain its number one imperial and naval and economic and colonial position. And what I was struck in writing this book, what I was struck by most, was that the debate going on in the United States right now and for the past 10 years has so many resounding echoes of the sort of things which are being debated by Edwardian Britons as they tried to confront this problem of relative decline. Relative, not absolute decline.
You know, it strikes me, have you ever, have you always been the kind of person who wanted to make sense of the world?
I started off like most historians in your own little patch, because your PhD has to be your patch. But I must say that I was always influenced by Oxford professors and lecturers who tried to see, you know, larger patterns in political development, who were willing to speak about bigger issues, who were not going to be very narrow specialists. And that has always attracted me, because I think that they were able to speak to more than their own profession. And this is to me is important. Historians should not abandon comments upon history, comments upon the so-called lessons of history, simply to journalists and politicians who are going to abuse the past, who are going to use history in an irresponsible way.
Yeah. Well, how about growing up, though? I mean, were you that way as a kid? Did people say to you, he always wants to know what's going on?
No, nothing like that at all. I was a normal sort of North Country English schoolboy, interested in soccer, interested in hill walking, interested in horse racing. No sort of real academic inclination until, I suppose, I started taking off in later levels of high school and at university, a sort of late developer.
Well, who did you write this book, Rise and Fall, for originally? Was it a kind of academic audience?
It was academic, but also a more general audience. It was, I must confess, at the beginning, it was going to look rather different from the way it has emerged. It was going to be much briefer. It was going to be a sort of essayistic set of reflections about why great powers rise and fall. And as I started making fairly sweeping comments upon the decline of Spain or the rise of the Dutch Republic, I began to lose my academic nerve and feel I better do much more reading about it and put in some more footnote references and some more facts and figures. So it grew in size. The other thing which changed was that it was originally intended much more as a history book, which might stop in 1945 or 1960, when the two superpowers were in place. That was the end of history. And yet, as I began writing the book and looking at the debate in Imperial Spain or Edwardian Britain about how to keep ahead, how to preserve your economic competitiveness, how to produce more engineers, how to avoid being overcommitted overseas, it struck me that that was so much like the debate going on in this country today, and so much like the sort of anxious debate going on in the Soviet Union today and under Mr. Gorbachev's perestroika and restructuring programs, that I should not stop in 1945. History does not stop. We are still in the stream of history, and the world is changing perhaps even faster than it has done in past centuries. And it seemed to me proper that a historian should try to suggest, as gently and I hope reasonably coherently as possible, the sorts of things which were bearing down on our present world and might change great power relationships in the future.
My guest is Yale Professor Paul Kennedy, author of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. Well, here you are on the bestseller list, and I bet your publisher had a fairly small first printing arranged. How many books?
Oh, yes, he did. He thought he was taking a risk with a quite large and, for trade book, reasonably expensive one. A risk at printing, I think, 7,500 copies.
7,000?
Yes.
And you're up to selling how many at this point?
Oh, it's somewhere over 200,000 and about eighth or ninth printing, and just goes on and on and on.
So you're rich now?
I've no idea about it. By the time agents and publishers and taxmen take their cut, I look forward to seeing what I am by September when some of it comes in.
Why do you think an academic book like this has hit it big? What do you think it is that everyday people are craving out there?
Well, I'm not sure about everyday people, but I now see an answer to that question, which I couldn't have seen 2.5 months ago. It's simply because of the whole variety of forums I've been asked to talk to. I think, first of all, that it wasn't just an academic history book because it didn't stop in 1945. The publisher would have been right to have been optimistic about 7,000 copies if it had done so.
What did it, though?
What it did was to touch upon a set of nerves which are clearly in evidence and rather frazzled in the American political culture at the moment. A large number of people, for example, are worried about the state of the educational system in the public schools. A large number are worried about how this average 17-year-old American compares with the Japanese or the Swiss or the German in terms of mathematical knowledge or technical knowledge.
So if you're worrying about some kind of deterioration, then the book might seem like an answer.
Yes, if you're worried about the federal deficit, then the book has significant historical case studies of powers who overspent themselves. If you're worried about whether the United States is carrying on too large a share of the global commitments of the free world, you may worry about the case studies or the implications from the story of overextended great powers of the past. And so I think what's happened is that this book has touched the concerns of perhaps 5 or 6 or more different constituencies. So one day I will go and talk to bankers or the stock market about the implications of fiscal turbulence and the excessive federal deficit. Another day I may be talking to manufacturers or organizations such as Rebuild America, led by Congressman Mel Levine. It's an interesting organization. You wouldn't have thought of Rebuild America 25 years ago. Now there are organizations out like that, and they are looking at the historical examples, which the book has, of societies which were number one great powers, which gradually had their economic competitiveness eroded.
Yes or no answer? Any thought of entering politics yourself?
Certainly not, no. Life as a professor at Yale, I think, is one of the most idyllic I can imagine, and going in and out of Washington in particular makes me see just how difficult it is to be a politician.
Thanks so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
My guest has been historian Paul Kennedy. His new book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, is published by Random House. I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Robert Parrish. His career in film started as a child when he appeared in Charlie Chaplin's City Lights. He went on to direct and edit films and won an Oscar for his editing of Body and Soul. Parrish has written 2 memoirs of his life in Hollywood. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. I'm filling in for Terry Gross, who's on vacation. Coming up, I speak with guitarist David Tenenbaum. He's only 31 years old, and yet Tenenbaum's done everything from adapting Renaissance lute music for guitar to playing rock music in the Soviet Union. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from Steve Wariner and George Strait. Now, both are called country singers. Ken says they have more in common with late 60s singer-songwriters like Bonnie Raitt and James Taylor. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the film adaptation of Neil Simon's coming-of-age play, Biloxi Blues. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. The White House said today it is asking American firms who owe taxes to Panama to place their payment in a special account in the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. The plan is designed to keep American dollars from flowing into Panama while the country is under the leadership of General Manuel Noriega. A number of American firms have already paid $3 million in taxes to the Noriega regime. In Panama today, there were more signs that the 10-day-old general strike is crumbling. Panamanian ports, as well as supermarkets, were back in business, and more stores are following their lead. NPR's Tom Jelton reports that the apparent collapse of the strike is forcing the opponents of General Noriega to consider new strategies.
When General Noriega's opponents here announced the beginning of their general strike, they said it would continue until Noriega stepped down from power and left Panama. But Noriega is still here, and with the strike falling apart, his opponents now are looking for another way to get him to leave. One option is negotiation. Previously, opposition leaders have taken a hard line against any dialogue with the Noriega regime. But the opposition now says it is preparing to accept a proposal for the Catholic Church in Panama to serve as a mediator with Noriega in the current crisis. Opposition leaders say they will insist that Noriega agree to leave as a precondition to any talks, but they are willing to negotiate the terms of Noriega's departure, as well as the process of transition to a new reconstituted government. The Archbishop of Panama, Marcus McGrath, would apparently serve as the mediator in these talks. In Panama City, I'm Tom Jelton.
House and Senate negotiators broke a long-standing deadlock today and moved to impose mandatory trade sanctions against the Toshiba Corporation of Japan and one of its subsidiaries. The subsidiary and a Norwegian firm sold high-technology equipment to the Soviet Union, which allowed the Soviets to produce quieter submarine propellers. The sanctions include a 3-year ban on government procurement of Toshiba products and a 3-year ban on imports of products made by the subsidiary. The provisions are part of a trade bill being considered in Congress. President Reagan has threatened to veto the trade bill if sanctions against the Japanese and Norwegian firms are included. The Pulitzer Prizes were announced this afternoon in New York. The awards, which are synonymous with the best in journalism, were first given in 1917. Andy Lyman reports on this year's winners.
Three newspapers won two Pulitzer Prizes each, and author Toni Morrison won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction for her novel Beloved. The Charlotte Observer won the 1988 Prize for Public Service for reporting on the PTL Ministry's misuse of funds. The Observer's former editorial cartoonist Doug Marlette also won. At the Wall Street Journal, Daniel Hertzberg and James B. Stewart won in explanatory journalism for coverage of insider trading and the stock market crash. The Journal's Walt Bogdanich also won specialized reporting for stories on faulty testing by American medical laboratories. Two Pulitzers went to the Miami Herald for feature photography, Michael Duciele, and for commentary, Dave Barry. The Alabama Journal and the Lawrence, Massachusetts Eagle Tribune won for general news reporting. Dean Baquet, William Gaines, and Anne-Marie Lipinski of the Chicago Tribune earned the award for investigative reporting. For National Public Radio, I'm Andy Lyman in New York.
The House Judiciary Committee today approved a measure that would give illegal aliens until November 30th to apply for legalization. The deadline is currently May 4th, but so far fewer illegals have applied for amnesty than had been expected. The Reagan administration opposes the extension. Stock prices closed higher in moderate trading on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 10 points to close at 1988.06. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of two new albums by Steve Wariner and George Strait, musicians you can hear on country stations. But Ken says their sound has tapped another kind of music.
Everybody says it just ain't gonna work out. Giving us a little bit of time and a whole lot of doubt. But I don't listen to a word of theirs. You know I love you and I know you care for me. And that's all that matters to me.
Country music has become the last refuge for a kind of music that used to be considered rock and roll. I'm talking about the music made by what were dubbed singer-songwriters. Think of the early work of James Taylor, Bonnie Raitt, John Prine, and quite a few others. In the late 60s and early 70s, these musicians coexisted on rock radio stations with everything from the Box Tops to Led Zeppelin, but no more. If the singer-songwriters are played at all, they're on so-called adult contemporary stations, the bulk of whose programming is little more than Muzak. That there's still an audience for this sort of work, however, is increasingly apparent. To take just one example, James Taylor's albums, even after all these years, always go gold, that is, sell more than 500,000 copies. But fans of this music are finding that more and more, their kind of sounds are being played on country music stations.
Flagging down a cab, you look so pretty. A country girl alone in New York City. Well, you got your big break doing what you wanna do. If I could do what I wanted, I'd be right with you. Dreams don't always turn out the way you plan. A day late and a moment short, and nothing in your hand. You keep running, running through my mind, like the taxis in the street, like Venice wine, like the rivers back home. Run so free, run anywhere you want. A baby, run to me.
That's Steve Wariner, a very popular singer, songwriter, and guitarist, with a new song called Runnin'. Wariner is considered a country artist, but don't you think his vocals on that song sound like Dave Mason? I keep expecting that tune to turn into Only You Know and I Know. It's also worth pointing out that that song was co-written by Wendy Waldman, another veteran of the 70s singer-songwriter trend. Steve Wariner's new album, I Should Be With You, offers a perfect example of the way some rock musicians have found a haven in the country market. Wariner's backup group on this album used to accompany James Taylor, Linda Ronstadt, and other rockers. They include drummer Russ Kunkel, bassist Leland Sklar, and keyboardist Billy Payne. Payne, some of you may recall, was once a member of the cult rock band Little Feat.
Sometimes I forget to thank you for all you've done for me. It slips my mind, but you forgive me and never even ask me why. But sweetness is in short supply. You give me more than enough to just get by, more than enough to satisfy.
That's a song called More Than Enough, ostensibly a country tune, but one written by a name familiar to most baby boomers, Jimmy Webb, who wrote pop songs like MacArthur Park and The Fifth Dimension's Up, Up and Away. It's clear from all this that the definition of just what is country has been drastically expanded over the past few years. That, in turn, has helped to create a larger, more diverse audience for a more tradition-bound country singer like George Strait. There's nothing pop or rock about that song called If You Ain't Lovin', You Ain't Livin'. It's pure country. But George Strait is very much a mainstream star. Now in his mid-30s, he's the same age as or even a bit younger than that first wave of rock singer-songwriters and their audience. He's as familiar with James Taylor's Sweet Baby James or Bob Dylan's Nashville Skyline period as he is with the music of country idols like Hank Williams, George Jones, and Merle Haggard, and he combines his influences into a seamless sound.
She looks so much like a lady, but she was so much like a child. A devil when she held me close, an angel when she smiled. She always held it deep inside, but somehow I always knew she'd go away when the grass turned green and the sky turned baby blue. Baby blue.
That's Baby Blue, as winsome a bit of treacle as James Taylor or Cat Stevens ever cut, and a song that shows the deleterious effects the pop influence on country can have. Chances are George Strait wouldn't have recorded that if he'd stuck to emulating Merle and George and Hank. At their best, however, both Steve Wariner and George Strait are offering a large number of newly disenfranchised rock listeners a place to hear the sort of melodic music they crave.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Cause words can't always tell it like it is sometimes when we're this close. The lights and music.
This is Fresh Air. David Tannenbaum made his professional debut at the age of 16. At 31, he's a recognized master of the classical guitar. From a new recording of lute music David Tannenbaum adapted for the classical guitar. Tannenbaum's interest in music for his instrument spans the centuries. He's performed contemporary music by Peter Maxwell Davies, and next year he'll be performing a new guitar piece composed by Steve Reich. Tannenbaum now lives in San Francisco, where he's chairman of the guitar department at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. He grew up in New York, surrounded by music.
My father is a composer who teaches at Manhattan School of Music and has been at the forefront of electronic music. In fact, when the first synthesizer was invented, we went up to New Hampshire and rented it from Robert Moog to experiment with it. So
is
I was always
so?
Hearing the sort of music on the forefront. And my mom is a pianist, so I grew up in the environment of music.
But I suspected you did. There was a little remark in Newsweek magazine about you where you made a statement. You said you would be, you know, playing away, and your mother, was it your mother who would come by and correct the notes?
Well, actually, either one. And also, there were many musicians that were around a lot, you know, just friends. And I would be playing, and of course, the piano was in the middle of the living room, and I was always being corrected in terms of tempo or notes or this and that. And it was very natural. I don't think they could resist. It's like living with your own teacher, you know. And my mom was my teacher for my first 2 years, starting when I was about five.
Did it make you mad to have someone correcting you? when you were a kid.
Yeah, I just got real frustrated. We used to fight all the time. And also, I was required to practice. Now I'm glad that I was, but then I wasn't. And the lessons were Sunday mornings, you know, and I just found the whole thing quite unfair, even though I loved music, you know, the requirements I didn't like. And actually, I got into more and more study. I studied the cello, and I studied the theory at the local conservatory. This was in Westchester in New Rochelle. And finally, when I was about 10 or 11, I started to do these student recitals. And I was really rebelling against it and not practicing so much and not doing so well in these recitals. And I remember thinking to myself, this is the one thing I know I won't do as a profession, which is to play music in front of people. And, of course, it turned out that it was the one thing I would do. But I was given the option by the teacher at the conservatory, Michael Pollan. He convinced my parents to let me quit all the instruments for a year. He thought it would just be a good idea. And so I did immediately. And what did I take up but electric guitar?
Electric.
Yeah, and I started to play rock and roll, and I had a rock band. And I, you know, my parents were always back there, I think, pulling strings, trying to get me into classical again. And my dad took me kicking and screaming to an Andre Segovia concert, who's the real grandmaster of classical guitar.
Yeah.
And I was just dumbfounded. I couldn't believe it. And he played a piece that I had known on the keyboard. And he had arranged it for guitar, and I tried to do an arrangement, but, you know, I didn't know the ins and outs of doing that. So I was struggling with this little tiny 2-minute Bach prelude for so long that it was obvious that I should take some lessons. So I started to take lessons. The minute I did, I went crazy with it. I started to practice long hours. Through high school, I practiced 8 hours a day.
But you took the lessons because you wanted to.
Because I wanted to. And also, the classical guitar was a quiet instrument, and it had a repertoire that was outside the mainstream. And I could basically shut and lock the door and could never be bothered. And I think that's another reason that I took to it so much.
And could never be corrected.
Yeah, that's right.
Your guitar, the sound of it is so beautiful. I was really hit by the particular sound of that instrument.
Yes, I love this instrument, and it's built by a former New Yorker who lives in California. It's built by a man named John Gilbert, who is a great character and decided to live on the West Coast, and in fact just rented a car with his wife and started to drive south from Seattle until he found the very place that he wanted to live, which ends up being Woodside, California. It's south of San Francisco. And he worked as a machinist for Hewlett-Packard until into his 50s. Never built a guitar. And a co-worker had a kit and was building one, and so John decided he would also do that. And he set up a shop in his garage and started to work at nights and weekends on building guitars. And he was getting himself exhausted, so he finally decided to just make a go for building guitars. And it's about 15 years later, and he's one of the most well-known makers in the world. It's something that's happened very quickly. Many of the most well-known makers are these sort of old families in Spain and in Europe that have been doing it for generations. And John Gilbert has become a household name amongst guitar makers. And his waiting list is something like 15 years long now.
15 years?
Yeah. There are hundreds of people on it, and he's now has his son as an apprentice to help him build some of these guitars.
Why is he good?
Well, he has a machinist's mind. He makes a full drawing of each of the guitars. And so, you know, the craftsmanship is really impeccable. But more than that, he seems to have this incredible talent for working with wood. There's a real art to that. And John will take me to his shop I'll tap on different faces of guitars that are just hanging there. And the art is matching the qualities of sound inherent in the face wood with the wood in the sides and back. They have to complement each other well. And he endlessly thinks about these things. And he does some very interesting things. He thinks the guitars really take on their character by being played. He feels that he wants to build them almost as neutrally as possible, sort of like a piano, and let the player provide the characteristic. So the first thing he does is the minute he finishes one, he calls me up and asks me to come down and play them. And we go outside to this redwood forest because the acoustic is the most true outside. And I sit in the very same chair for each guitar. And I play, and he goes and takes a walk. He walks around the back of the guitar, and then he takes a walk down this path, and he sees what the projection of the guitar is. And he feels, you know, he'll be able to tell the qualities of the guitar. And if he doesn't have a guitar maker around, if I'm on tour, he actually hangs the guitar up in front of the radio and plays the radio into the sound box of the guitar and lets it vibrate with sound. And he feels that will break it in, but he says he'll only play classical music into the guitar.
Tell me about the nails on your hand.
Well, I have nails on the right hand only, and not on the left.
Long, you mean?
Yes, long nail. Right. I have to keep them short on the left hand. But classical guitarists play with all the fingers except the pinky on the right hand. And this is, as you can imagine, a rather delicate way to make a living, to have fingernails. And until fairly recently, there was not a really good viable alternative to fingernails in case you broke one. I used to have concerts where I would break a nail and I would just be in big trouble and sometimes have to cancel. Then there was a kit developed called player's nails, especially for classical guitarists. And it was $25. It comes in this little package of nails of different sizes with some modified crazy glue. Somebody figured out after a while that these are actually cut-up ping pong balls. That if you take ping pong balls and cut them up in the shape of nails, you can use them as fake nails.
And do guitarists do that?
The guitarists do that. And in fact, I had this incredibly difficult week to do early this year. I went from the West Coast to Vienna on a Monday, played a couple concerts, took a polar flight back on Saturday to the West Coast, played one concert on Sunday, and then went back to London the next day, on next Monday. So it was a very difficult week, and on the very first plane flight from the West to the East Coast, I broke my fingernail, and this, of course, was the one time that I did not have my player's nails with me. So what I had to do is, when I got to Vienna, I had to figure out how to say ping pong ball in German, and then I could fix my situation.
When you're performing, what is it you want to have happen to make yourself feel happy?
Well, what I want to have happen for myself is that for me, time and everything else just disappears. That I get so lost in the experience that, frankly, I can hardly remember it afterward. And that's one of the great experiences that happens for me when I play. And I hope to communicate that. I hope that we all get lost in this experience. You know, one of the great things about music is that it's a nonverbal art. And so one of the things I work with when I perform is to try to make thoughts sort of go away. And of course, thoughts come up. They always do. But it's what we want to try to get is the shift of attention where we get away from the thoughts and back into the physical sensation of the music.
I hate to end this interview because I'm having such a good time talking with you.
Well, I am too, and that's really nice.
Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you.
David Tenenbaum's new recording, Lute Masterworks, is on the Innova label. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi.
What's going on?
Well, today in Washington, Edwin Meese is over at the White House. He's talking to the president. So far, there's no suggestion that the attorney general will resign, but we'll have a report on exactly what does happen. We also have a report on a community of hidden Jews in New Mexico. Faith, have you ever heard of that?
No.
Well, these are people who are known to academics as crypto-Jews, and they're descendants of Jews who fled Spain in the 16th century to escape the Inquisition. And many of these hidden Jews maintain underground, literally, traditions and some religious rituals of their ancestors.
Interesting. Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Biloxi Blues, which is based on the second of Neil Simon's three plays about a young man named Eugene Morris Jerome. Now, Stephen doesn't like the movie very much, but he says there is one outstanding performance.
In Biloxi Blues, Christopher Walken is like a circus clown at a funeral. He's the only splotch of color in sight, and whenever he appears, your eye seizes upon him hungrily. The movie version of Neil Simon's autobiographical Broadway hit isn't boring or even unabsorbing, but it's crushingly bland and mild and subdued. At this late date, filming a World War II service comedy, or even more familiar, a basic training picture, seems an almost lunatic proposition. After all the TV sitcoms and all the movies and plays, how can anyone make this material feel fresh? Neil Simon and his director Mike Nichols don't even try. Matthew Broderick gives a winning performance as Simon's alter ego, Eugene Jerome, but as he heads for the boot camp in Biloxi, Mississippi, you can feel yourself wearily predicting what he'll find. And that plop, plop, plop you hear throughout the movie is the sound of all those predictable scenes and situations dropping into place. We get the introductory run-in with the drill sergeant, the torture of the sensitive intellectual type by the barracks bully, our hero's first sexual experience at the hands of the usual hooker with a heart of gold, our hero's love affair with a local girl. Am I missing anything? Oh, yeah, the scene in which we find out how bad that army food is.
Don't approve of our cuisine, Jerome?
It's not that, Sergeant. It's a religious objection. This is the week that my people fast for 2 days.
This is July, Jerome. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur in September. I have an all-religious calendar in my barracks room.
It's a different holiday. It's called El Malagueña.
El Malagueña?
It's for Spanish Jews.
Connie, bring your food. Come on. Put half your food onto Jerome's tray.
Yes, Sergeant.
Eat in good health, Jerome, and happy El Malagueña to you.
That was Matthew Broderick as Private Jerome and Christopher Walken as Weird Sergeant Toomey. And even in that little scene, you can hear how striking Walken's approach to the character is, how rich and strange and oddly spiced. Walker makes the usual drill sergeant into a wily, seductive, insinuating figure. In fact, he brings so many unexpected shades to the character that the movie can't accommodate them all. Simon hasn't written his screenplay for an actor as inventive and mercurial as Walken, and in a way, the performance backfires. By the end of the movie, you don't care much about the recruits. You want to know more about Sergeant Toomey. You want some light shed on the inner caverns this performance reveals. Simon seems to regard Biloxi Blues as a coming-of-age movie, a portrait of a great writer, himself, as he learns to observe and explore and put together the tools of his art. Walken makes you feel this callow young writer has missed the point, that he's left his most fascinating character in the dust, the better to burble on about first love and how young he was then and how much older and sager he is now. Biloxi Blues flickers by easily enough, but the only impression it leaves is one of anomaly and incongruity. It's a 50s-style movie with an incendiary 80s-style performance at its center.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On the next show, I'll speak with Peter Phillips, the director of the Talis Scholars, 10 singers who perform Renaissance choral music. Phillips describes his work as trying to fuse those 10 voices into one perfect instrument. Pianist Mac Rebenack will be back to play 2 songs in tribute to Louis Armstrong. And critic at large Laurie Stone says Cole Porter meant it when he titled his musical Anything Goes. She'll review the Lincoln Center revival starring Patti LuPone. I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Dougherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.